I'm not gonna put my hands.
Hands on the table?
Yeah, give me a whap. It's okay.
Call Senator Hess together. We have Senators Hoffman, Menard, Fisher, and Sturzaluski. I'd like to make a couple of just announcements of committee business and how I had an occasion to discuss. I'm hoping all issues with all of you, but I attempted to contact you. The first one was on Senate Bill 215. That's the prison population management bill. We have heard that Mike Stark has brought it, and it's the alternative to the Cleary case in case of a problem. We had some very optimistic words that came from the consultant on corrections, but I think there's a little feeling of let's see that report and let's see what it's going to take to implement it. So the AG is real interested in seeing that bill go forward. So I have brought that before us. As Senate Bill 215 is going to be before us on Wednesday of next week. If you have concerns about that bill, I hope you will get them to me. The intention would be to send that on to finance, and then as finance and we do the budget overviews, that bill will be in the committee. If there's any objection to that, I appreciate knowing that. The other issue I brought to you was Senate Bill 337, which is the RIP bill, early retirement, to ask if you had any objection to waiver. And in discussion with you, a couple of issues came up, and it warrants our having that bill heard, and I am going to bring that before us next Tuesday. They were in the area of kind of the brain drain issue. We're losing good people, and also a longer term cost issues and what happens with PERS and TERS over a longer period. And I'll get Randy Welker, who did legislative budget and audit, and if there are other questions on that, you might get to me. So we will be scheduling that. Now, I'd like to talk about the education bill. We know that at this point it is premature for anybody to say how that's going to end up, just because of the funding issues and so on. But I think there's a strong feeling people want to make a statement on education. What I would like to do is to move forward in the form that they have. We will need to adopt on Senate Bill 316 Senator Curtula's CS on debt service. We already have before us Senator Fisher's bill, Senate Bill 20. But this is what I would propose doing. Yeah, let's be sure we have everything out before us. But I'd like to make a proposal to you. We've had a good presentation by Nat Cole on behalf of the single site issue. I don't know if their proposal is a better proposal than we had last year, where there was quite a bit of support. If you'll remember, in Senate Bill 7, where we had the soups and the school boards and a whole bunch of people come before us with a proposal. Now, the House knocked that out. I think we need to address that in terms of an authorization bill. So what I'm suggesting to you is that I go ahead, work with the commissioner, work with the single site folks, work with various educational groups, bring back, and we can get that introduced sometime next week and then work on it in committee, an authorization bill or an amendment to the formula that will deal with the single site issue. We've also had an issue raised by Senator Cotton, and that would be up to him to put in legislation on that we could also consider. He is concerned at the upper end when you have an extraordinary number of people in the classroom and that issue. And so we could, take a look at that as well as the other issue. So that would be the proposal I make to you, and I would be happy to have any discussion on it. But I would like to move the two bills forward, realizing we're going to work on the authorization. If we can send that forward, then finance will have that information and be able to adjust it. Does that sound like a plan that you can accept? Okay. So, having said all of that.
Aren't we getting along good?
Well, you're all being very quiet, so I'm nervous. But let us then turn to Senate Bill 20. I did not have the information the other morning, which is a rare lapse on my part, but we had adopted by Senator Cotton's motion the committee substitute for the second sponsor substitute for Senate Bill number 20. So what it would take would be simply a motion to move that bill from committee.
Mind if I move it?
Move it.
Move committee substitute for second sponsor substitute for Senate Bill number 20 out of committee with individual recommendations.
Do I hear any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
That's it, that's cool.
Are we going to take that bill?
You feel better.
Well, I got something else on you.
You're
yeah,
you're
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Then we will bring Senate Bill 316. Senator Curtula, and I have spoken to Senator Curtula, and he would like the bill to reflect the debt service, and you have before you a committee substitute which does need to be adopted. Senator Menard.
Madam Chair, I'll move that we adopt the committee substitute.
Is there any objection? So ordered. I would like to see that bill moved from the committee.
I'll go ahead and make the motion that we move CS for second sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 316 from Hess with individual recommendations.
Senator?
Just ask a question. This is reflecting the so-called full entitlement.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Do I hear any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. And I would hope to be back to you next week with a Senate bill. Senator Hoffman?
No.
We will go on teleconference now, and we do have two pieces of legislation. Senate Bill 288, payments to health facilities, which we will hear. They're very likely will not move that bill today, but we will take testimony, and we do have people on teleconference. And also, we have Senate Bill 328, elected municipal officials, by Senator Fisher. I'd like first to take Senate Bill 288, payments to health facilities. We do have people to be heard, as well as people on teleconference. Since this is the first time that we have had the bill up, it is by the Rules Committee, by request of the governor, I would ask that the administration come forward and present the bill to us. Jay, are you Jay Lively? You would come forward and identify yourself and understand this is the first time we've had the bill, so we would like to have a little bit of detail. And I might I'd like to point out to the committee that you have on this packet, you have some suggested changes. I did not make order up a committee substitute because I thought it best to hear what you're presenting, and then we can go from there. Jay, would you go ahead, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jay Lively, Deputy Commissioner of Health and Social Services. With me is Mike Sanders, who's the head of the department's audit unit.
What this bill does is allows the department to do audits of health facilities, and as a result of those audits, to recoup funds that the department, that the audits show, have been overpaid. In a nutshell, that's all the bill does. Without this, without SB 288, the department can effectively cannot audit and recoup for overpayments. Let me give you a little history of how this bill came about. In 1983, the state adopted a new prospective payment system, which changed the way we paid hospitals and nursing homes for care for Medicaid patients. That, as a result of that, we began to audit and to recoup funds. That was challenged in the Supreme Court by facilities. The Supreme Court, in the court case, Cordova case, said that the department can audit, but we do not have the statutory authority to go in and take money back, that money that was identified as a result of the audit. So what this bill does is goes back and fixes the law so that we are able to go in and take that money back. The original bill that we proposed was a bill that allowed us to go back and to recoup funds for prior fiscal years. And in the proposed language and a suggested change that we would make to the bill would be to make the recoupment provisions effective only in the future, so that beyond the effective date of the bill, we can audit and recoup, but we cannot go back and recoup from past years. Now, we've changed that for a couple of reasons. One, there was concern, frankly, in the AG's office that that kind of a retroactive provision, where in essence this legislature was interpreting what a previous legislature meant, was marginal in court. Secondly, we would be going back and presenting recoupment bills to many facilities who may not have the money to pay them, and we want to precipitate a crisis, particularly in the smaller facilities. And thirdly, frankly, some of that old audit information is getting fairly old at this point. So we determined that we'd be better off coming in here and just asking for the ability to recoup from the effective date of the bill forward.
I wonder if you could comment that, just taking a look at your fiscal note, you're looking at some relatively substantial dollars, right, as potentially collectible. I would like either you or Mr. Sanders to explain a bit of how the audit works and why these figures are so large. When we start looking at a couple $1 million, that's really very significant. How does this process work?
Let me make a general comment, and then Mike can help me out on the detail. To really ask about the audits, you have to ask about how we set rates. And the way we set rates is, we look for FY, for example, for the fiscal year beginning in fiscal year 92, for a facility's fiscal year begins 7/1/92. We will take their FY 90 expenditures, and we will audit those expenditures. And we will audit those expenditures because what we do is take their FY 90, the facility's FY 90 expenditures, inflate them forward 2 years, make a few other adjustments, and that becomes the FY 92 rate. So the FY 92 rate is based on expenditures from FY 90. To the extent that, what that means is, of course, that if we don't audit those 90 expenditures before we set the 92 rate, then we're essentially setting a rate on expenditures that we haven't verified. And I was thinking about this bill last night, and actually I was thinking about this as I was doing my taxes, and I have a rental in my house, and I'm sitting there thinking how much of my heat and electricity I'm going to allocate to my apartment. And you know, if it weren't for the IRS being able to come back and audit me, the 40% that I normally allocate, you know, might be 43 or it might be 45 or it might be 50. And sort of the same thing goes in to this calculation, because we have to isolate Medicaid expenditures. And the way to verify those Medicaid expenditures is to do an audit and then to set the rate on those expenditures. Mike can give you a better example of the kinds of adjustments that show up as audit exceptions, you know, as a result of that, if we want to get into that detail.
I would like to, but first, Senator Menard, and would you, you are on teleconference.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. In setting this and then going forward, you know, not being retroactive, then is there or should there be any provision that the state audit be done within a certain period of time? Because you go back 5 years or something like that, or and with that, if it's done within a certain amount of time, and then maybe if there's gross negligence or something, you can go all the way back, similar to what the IRS does.
Madam Chair, we sympathize with that. In a perfect world, and conceptually, what we should be doing is we should only be setting a prospective rate on audited information. And then once you set that prospective rate, then what would happen is if the facility provides a service for a lower cost than the rate, they keep that money. If they provide it for a higher cost, then we take the money. Then the rate system will account for that in later years and take some of that money back. excuse me, the reality is the way our rate setting system works, and based on the amount of resources we have in auditing, and frankly the amount of resources we expect to have in the future, we can't get those rates audited before we set the rate. You know, that we just don't have, we don't have the resources. We're going to try to, we're almost, by the end of next year we will be almost caught up, and then we will hope to stay caught up. That's the first part of the question. The other part of your question has to do with how far back, even if we can't set a prospective rate on the audited information. The second part of your question goes to how far back, you know, what should be a limit to which we can go to force us to keep up within a reasonable space of time so information doesn't get stale. And I, you know, I agree with you that that would be a good thing to have. I don't know what that time period is, and I don't know to what extent we're willing to trade off that time period for not being able to get the state's money back if there are overpayments.
Senator, go ahead.
Well, my only point, Madam Chair, is that if a home or whatever had a rate and they were paid in, according to your audit, X amount, and they already spent that money, and you don't come back in for the audit, and if this legislation was passed now and say you're not in doing the audit in 1997, you know, thereabouts, you know, those long terms, if depending on what it is, it seems like for an institution, if it was a moderate to large sum, whatever, and they've already spent it and they've already gone on and things are trucking along, it seems like there should be some kind of a limit as far as going back, because I presume they assume everything's hunky-dory, and then all of a sudden, way back when, and then as things go in Alaska, they've already changed administrators and, you know, different boards and whatever, you know.
Would you, sorry.
Okay.
Yes, thanks. Fine. Would you care to respond?
Yes, Madam Chair. Senator Menard, I agree with you that that would be a good thing to have. Again, my concern is whether or not in the future we'll have the resources to keep up with some kind of a schedule like that, and of course it would depend on what the window of opportunity,
right,
you know, would be determined.
Go ahead.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that we should think about that, and we should think that there's some window. I don't know what the time frame should be, and maybe we could get some thoughts come to the table on that, but I think there should be some time frame in there.
Mm-hmm. Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My question is on similar lines, and you got to have a limitation, I think, out there in fairness to the hospitals. The other one, I'm just looking at the fiscal note. You have revenue of $940,000, but no expenditures. Why is that?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Senator. Can I get a copy of that fiscal note? I have one.
Yes.
I'm not sure if the...
We're fine to deal with the resources on the
other. Yeah. I think what that refers to is that we're planning to not increase the amount of audit resources we're already using. So expenditures wouldn't necessarily increase, and I presume that the revenue that shows here shows recoupments coming back to the state as a result of being able to now recoup on audits that are being done.
A question on the audit process itself. Most of the institutions, I'm assuming, have CPAs doing the audit anyhow. So what additional things do you need to take so long? Somebody had mentioned the other day about a desk audit or something. Why can't we make it more simple so that in a timely manner, the institutions, you can go in a couple days, agree or not agree, and then start the negotiation process?
I'd like to have Mike answer that, but my layperson's understanding of what a desk audit is would be the equivalent, essentially, of an IRS agent calling me up and saying, gee, about that refrigerator in your apartment, did you really purchase that? And I say yes. We anticipate that a desk audit might catch 30% of the adjustments that a full audit would find, but I'd like Mike.
Yeah, I think it would be useful to us to go a bit through the process, and it's always easy to say we don't have enough resources. Let's talk a little bit about what happens out there, and in a way, I'm curious if we passed the rate setting commission in 85, 86?
80s.
Am I wrong?
Well, the Medicaid Rate Commission, I believe, began then, but then Medicaid, it became the Medicaid Rate Advisory Commission through executive order in 1987.
So when did this court, just again, kind of historical knowledge, when did this court, how soon did this issue really arise, and has it been going through the courts for a long period of time? Is that?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure when the suit was filed. Maybe there may be someone in the audience who knows exactly.
All right. Well, we can get into that. But apparently, this has been some time in brewing, it sounds like.
Madam Chair, I suspect that it took at least 3 or 4 years for this case from the time it was first filed to get its way through the court system.
The opinion was in 90, but it goes, I'm sure it goes back considerably. Yes, would you identify yourself for the record, please, and tell us a bit about the process?
Yes, I'm Mike Sanders. I'm the audit manager for the audit unit with Health and Social Services. And to answer your question, the Cordova case was based on 1985 audit and was finalized in 1990. At least that's when the Supreme Court decision was rendered. So it does take a fair bit of time to get these things through the judicial system, that's for sure. To kind of briefly run through the audit process, we attempt to do a desk review type of analysis on each facility each year, as it just really serves a twofold purpose. One purpose is a sort of analysis to determine the necessity of field audit, and also to determine the scope of the field audit and where the risk areas are. We do get audited financial information from the individual facilities' CPAs, and they are very helpful. And many of our adjustments to the cost reports, the Medicare cost report and the Medicaid cost report, are to adjust those costs to reflect the CPA's results, the result of the CPA audit. Because of the timing of the when the cost reports need to be filed, both with Medicare and with the Medicaid programs, oftentimes the CPA's audit is not complete at that time, and therefore the adjustments never seem to get reflected back into the cost reports, or at least don't. Frequently they don't. So many of our adjustments are essentially bringing the cost reports back into generally accepted accounting costs. There are a lot of things that go into the Medicaid rate calculation that have nothing to do with generally accepted accounting. For example, patient days is very critical in you know, how many Medicaid patient days you had as opposed to total patient days. That sort of thing is very critical for the rate setting analysis, and it's not critical at all for generally accepted accounting, and therefore some additional audit work is obviously called for there. As well as cost allocations between between departments and between administration and actual client service is critical for rate setting calculation and not critical at all for generally accepted accounting, as well as allocations between, say, gift shops and surgery centers and that sort of things. So those are basically the kinds of things that the audit process brings forward. To just talk about a little bit about a time frame for getting these audits complete. It is reasonable that we would have a statutory type limitation on the amount of time to consider these audits, and obviously we do try to stratify our work from the most critical areas down to the least critical areas, which would involve looking at the hospitals and nursing homes and that do receive more Medicaid payments. So obviously the ones that would be left over would be the smaller facilities. A lot of the larger facilities have home offices and located in other locations. It's obviously totally impractical for us to go to these other locations and audit the home offices in order to determine if the allocation is correct to the state of Alaska. These audits are done by the Medicare intermediaries, and they work roughly on a 2 to 3 year completion schedule. So a couple years after the rates have already been paid and everything, we wind up with a audit adjustment report from usually Blue Cross that have to do with the allocations from the home offices. So we're really looking at maybe a 4-year time frame or something like that in order to be able to include all of the adjustments that would normally come through. Basically is a real brief sketch of the process.
So what happens after all of this is completed, according to the court case? What is the reason you do not have the authority to collect? I mean, you find the problem. All right, and so why do we end up here needing legislation, simply put?
Thank you for your question, Senator. Reason we don't have the ability to recoup is because the original statute that's on the books right at the moment says that we will do audits of these facilities. And it's fairly clear on that point. What's implied is that there will be a settlement after that audit. What's not determined yet, still remains to be determined, I guess, is whether or not the facilities that have been identified as being underpaid should be underpaid as a result, should be compensated as a result of the audits. Obviously, the only question that came before the courts is whether the overpayment is due back. Originally, I'm sure that the intention was that there would be a settlement after these audits. However, it was not specifically stated so in the statute, and therefore, on that point, it came to the court system, and the courts read, of course, the very letter of the law and determined that no overpayments were due as a result of these audits.
All right. What about the thrust of this legislation? Do you deal both with over and under?
Yes.
Yes.
Certainly sounds fair, doesn't it?
Yes.
All right. Senator Hoffman?
Well, then the health care facilities are saying that the overpayment, they want to keep those payments at this time?
It hasn't gone to court yet as far as that goes.
And then if they're underpaid, they want to be paid the difference. But if they're overpaid, they don't want to recoup the costs to the state.
The underpayments haven't gone to court yet, but the overpayments have. And the court specifically says overpayments won't be recouped.
Unless there's a change in the law.
Exactly.
Senator Fisher.
I'm just curious, how many institutions do you deal with as far as audits of this nature go?
I believe the number is 29 at the moment.
Thanks.
Are there other questions? Senator Menard.
And following up on that, with the 29, then how many auditors do you have that work in this area?
I have 3 auditors that work in this area. We have had in the last several years also some contract dollars available, and so we've been able to do some of the audits with contract CPAs.
I'm curious, although you're are suggesting in your proposed changes that this be prospective and not retrospective, could you give us a figure of how much is on the table, both overages and under and over, as a result of your audits to date? How many dollars are we talking about that have been discovered but are in dispute because of the court case?
About roughly $2 million
about
that's been discovered, yes.
Fine. Senator Fisher?
And that covers how many years for all the institutions?
That covers from 85 through current. However, I might add that because of these court situations and because of just the nature of the system, we have a lot of audits that are currently underway that are not complete.
Senator Fisher.
You had just mentioned that some of this kind of auditing that you do, you contract out with the CPA.
Yes.
Can't you develop some kind of a process or a form or something simple that the hospitals with their CPAs can do all this? And since you have a CPA saying this is my seal, you don't have to do much more, would you?
That is a possibility. I feel like it would be a fairly large supplemental package of procedures that they have to go through for you to have a certified cost report, and I'm sure the facilities can probably tell us better than I can, but I believe it's extremely expensive to get an actual certified cost report filed in terms of CPA expenditures. Without, you know, short of that, short of having a certified cost report, the CPAs that we hire are not doing procedures that lead to generally accepted accounting conclusions. They are specifically doing test work in the patient days and in the cost of care, providing care, similar to what staff auditors do, and it's a totally different, separate type of audit. It is possible, to answer your question maybe a little more specifically, to have the facility CPAs do those things. However, I believe it would be extremely expensive.
So that would be a cost shifting then. In order to get the information, you would need to make the judgment on the rates.
Yes.
Yeah. Senator Menard.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So following up on your time frame on my earlier questioning, if I understand you correctly, that by the time you go through and do your audit and then all the information comes back and stuff, and was it including even court time that the window was 4 years or without court time, if it gets to that point?
I'm not sure how long the court time takes, Senator. It seems to take a long time.
Okay.
We still have court pending issues from 85 and 86 that are still yet to be litigated, and I'm not sure how long it takes to get through the court system, but a long time.
But just your procedure and getting the reports back from the insurance companies and everything else, was that 4 years that you're?
Yes, sir. I believe 4 years would 4 years from the end of the year, given another 4 years, we would cover most of the critical areas, no question about it.
It seems like a real long window, but I don't know.
We have no lawyers here to explain it to us.
Yeah, I guess maybe that's it. Yeah.
That's a blessing.
Yeah.
Senator Fisher.
Is there a interest charge? Let's say that you go through all this system and at the end somebody owes you $100,000. Do you get interest or penalties for all those 4 years, or is it just what's overdue?
It's just what's overdue. There's no interest calculated at this point.
They'd be glad to get that.
Senator Cotton.
Well, there really is no dispute anymore, though, right? As far as recouping overpayments. There's no longer a dispute. Are you appealing that?
No, Senator, in order for us to be able to recoup, we need to have SB 288 passed to specifically change the statute so that recoupment can occur.
The court found that was not clear, and so unless we do pass this, you're not able to.
Right, but there's no longer any dispute over past overpayments.
No, not really. The only dispute that was out there in the past was that the original version of SB 288 allowed us to go back and recoup in the future. But with us going forward with a new version that just allows us to recoup prospectively, then there's no argument over clearly the law does not allow us to recoup in the past.
Are there other questions? We'll want you standing by.
Madam Chair, can I make?
Yes, certainly. Go ahead.
Just one more comment, just to give a little perspective on this. We know we're talking about the Medicaid program in FY 93. I believe the budget for facility portion of Medicaid is about $128 million.
This is go ahead, Senator.
Did we discuss their proposed changes to the legislation?
Yes, why don't we take a look at those? I believe the first changing it to prospective is carried through in the two that we have. Is that correct? Would you go ahead and make comment?
That's correct. The original version of the bill allowed us to recoup even in the past years. The changes that are reflected here would allow us to recoup from past years, but only from the effective date of the bill forward.
While we have you here before us, we were very pleased, I was pleased in a meeting with Commissioner Mala to learn that on Medicaid you had been aggressively pursuing additional federal funds or payment, and that you had somewhere located somewhere in the neighborhood of, I thought the figure was $4 million. The commissioner just went back to Washington with a very specific aim, I thought, of taking a look at the larger issue where other areas are, other states are recouping more by either breaking down into smaller segments as to those areas that have particular demographic and other problems. And I'm just wondering if that's something this committee is very interested in that. Is there any hope, could we benefit by an appearance from you very soon to talk on this subject? Where, what was learned back there? Obviously, that figure of $128 million is shocking, and we know that not all issues are covered under that. So if we could just digress into that a minute, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're absolutely right. There's sort of two things going on for the Medicaid program. The first thing we're trying to do is identify individuals who are being served by state programs currently under all general fund and determine whether, if those individuals are Medicaid eligible, we can start providing
shifting
services.
Shifting some of those
Medicaid
in so we pick up 50%
yeah,
at
we
least.
We call it Medicaid refinancing is the buzzword we use, but that's exactly, you're exactly right, that's going on. So we stretch our general funds further. Excuse me, the disadvantage of that, of course, is the Medicaid budget goes up,
mm-hmm.
but that's half federal.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue you raised is the issue of, is there any leeway for the state to convince the Healthcare Financing Administration that the state's Medicaid match should be different than the 50-50 we currently have? The Medicaid match is dependent on a formula used by HCFA that uses per capita income. And if you look at states with low per capita incomes, the Mississippi's, Arkansas's, Alabama's, they have matches that are range anywhere from 65% to 70%.
Mm-hmm.
So what we thought was that we would take a look at how the formula works, because there seems to be a possibility that our numbers are skewed because of summer migration of workers into the state who don't live here but come here and work. If they earn the money here, then the money gets counted on Alaska's per capita income. So we're working with the Department of Labor to try to figure out if there's some way that we can recalculate those numbers and come up with a better match rate.
We would like to have, as soon as possible, a discussion, at least how you're proceeding and
okay.
how we might assist in case it takes, I don't know if it takes any negotiation or what weight we might lend to that, but it's hard for me to believe that in a state like this with certain areas with extraordinary unemployment figures, if we pull everything in together, it can skew those figures. And so I think we'd like to understand more how that formula works and what the opportunities are. We're faced with a very difficult situation in funding, and this is a critical issue that we can't wait for 4 years to solve it if that opportunity exists.
Madam Chair, the other issue we're pursuing with them is the whole idea that per capita income Alaska, because the cost of living, of course, is not the
mm-hmm.
same as per capita
right.
income other places, and pursuing the chance of some kind of adjustment there.
Is this basically what Governor Tommy Thompson did, in, I believe, Minnesota, cut their costs? Do you know if it was based on this?
I'm not sure.
Okay, fine. Sorry to interrupt, but this issue was discussed yesterday, and I think it's one that there's general interest in. Thank you. Gary, would you like to join us at the table? I do want to check quickly on the teleconference. We have Carl Garber and Jane Griffith. Are you in a problem with time, or can you hear the presentation of Gary Pesca, and then we could go to you?
We would like to hear the presentation of Gary Pesca.
All right. We'll go ahead then, and Gary, welcome, and would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Gary Pesca. I'm the Financial Vice President of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. I'd like to say, first off, that the association members are not opposed to the department having the authority to conduct Medicaid audits. The members believe that rates should be set based on timely audit information. They are opposed to this bill because they believe it reverses the basic concept of prospective rate setting in Alaska's Medicaid reimbursement system. As you've heard, we have a prospective rate setting system now. That means that each facility's reimbursement rates are negotiated and set before the beginning of the fiscal year. If the facility is efficient and costs are lower than the predetermined Medicaid reimbursement rate, the facility shares a profit with the state. If they're inefficient, costs exceed the reimbursement rate, the facility takes a loss. Senate Bill 288 would change the Medicaid reimbursement system to allow for recoupment based on audits completed long after the end of the facility's rate year. The department has an audit backlog now that spans several years, as you just heard. The facilities don't think it's reasonable to do an audit 4 or 5 years late and then ask them to pay money back to Medicaid because the audit discloses misinterpretations or disagreements over the meaning of regulations. If fraud is indicated, the association believes the state does have and should have the authority to recover the fund. In the Supreme Court decision that you heard about just a few minutes ago, the court said the following, quote, "We would have no hesitation in ordering a refund of money which had been awarded based on false representations. Likewise, if the grant had been expended for an illegal purpose, a refund would be appropriate. However, those situations do not exist here." That was in the case of Cordova and Petersburg's 1985 and 86 audits. The association finance officers have offered a number of suggestions for how the department might be able to clear up the audit backlog and stay current. For example, association members believe the department should make more use of desk audits instead of full field audits, especially for the facilities that receive the latest amount of Medicaid funds. And by the way, my definition of a desk audit is not that I call you up and ask you a question and you give me an answer and I say, fine. My definition of a desk audit is that I look at your financial statements, I might ask you to send me some copies of some of the documents that support your costs, and I might look at your trends compared to other hospitals of your size, and then decide if I need to send field auditors out to your facility. The association believes the department auditors should focus their audit procedures on those financial areas that affect the prospective rate-setting process. We've reviewed audit adjustments that the department's auditors have prepared in the past. We see audit adjustments that reclassify assets or revenue accounts when those adjustments have no effect on Medicaid reimbursement rates. We also see adjustments for $5 or $10. You've heard that the request for facilities portion of Medicaid for fiscal 1983 is $127 million. We just don't believe that $5 and $10 audit adjustments are worth the auditor's time, and we believe that that lends itself to increasing the backlog. Generally, auditors will establish a materiality threshold, and they won't even bother with audit adjustments below the threshold dollar amounts. The association members believe that the department's Medicaid audits could be done on a timely basis if the audit scope and purposes were better defined. If this bill is to pass, the association members believe it should include a requirement that the Medicaid audits be timely completed. The association members believe timely completed means within 6 months of the date the facility has to submit the final Medicaid cost reports for the year to the Medicaid Rate Advisory Commission. The association members also suggest that the bill should require the department to promulgate regulations governing the conduct of Medicaid audits of hospital and nursing home facilities. Those regulations should include definitions of A, field audits and desk audits, B, the scope and purposes of audits for Medicaid purposes, C, timing of audits, D, timing of and procedures for reflecting audit findings in rate setting, and E, the process for facilities to appeal audit findings.
You're looking at that through the regulatory process?
We believe that this bill should contain language that requires the department to promulgate regulations defining those specific areas at a minimum.
I'd like to ask you, and I want to hear the rest of your testimony, but you have some very specific suggestions. I would appreciate if you would get those to us if we could have those identified and would take a look at those.
Yes.
Fine.
The Association Healthcare Finance Committee met this week and reviewed the language the department said that they were going to propose in a sponsor substitute or a committee substitute for the bill. I haven't seen the final language, so we haven't actually marked one up and put page number, line number, change the following. But
a committee substitute. We had three amendments, so that's what we have. It does make it prospective, and those were the only changes that were proposed.
Okay, fine. Then I can address that more
specifically.
Fine,
thank you.
At this point, I'd be happy to answer questions from the committee, Madam Chair.
But it sounds like to me that you're willing to work on this, but you have some real concerns, and we'll get we'll have further discussion with you on those. Senator Fisher?
Thank you. We just had testimony that said it would probably take about 4 years to go through the whole system. At least that's what I thought I heard. By the time they go to check with DC or whatever it is, and you're saying 6 months. That seems to be a pretty big spread. Is it possible, though, really to do what they need to do, do you think, in 6 months?
I think it is with most of the facilities. I think they talked a little bit this morning about the problem with home office reports, with audits coming in on home office reports late. Well, that doesn't affect any of the municipally owned hospitals or any of the small nursing homes that don't allocate costs from home offices in the state. Maybe we need to treat the larger facilities differently from the smaller facilities, and we'd be willing to look at that approach as well.
Senator Menard?
Well, my concern is along that line, too, and maybe, like you say, we should break out the larger facilities with the smaller facilities. But it just seems like, and maybe it's a trend of government or where, when we talk to agency people, like we just talked to this group here, and they have three auditors and 29 facilities and all this going on. Do all of these, is it all facilities on the same timeline as far as their financial year end? I mean, do they all come at a certain date? And then you said that if they were going to be audited from that point, all of those audits would have to be done in that period of time or not?
No, Madam Chair, no. They don't all have the same fiscal year. Their fiscal years vary. So they don't get hit with every facility's financial statements at the same time every year.
But they all are within a year's period, though. All of them end up.
Well, there are new rates within each set for each year.
There are new rates set for each year for 2 years after the end of the fiscal year.
Right.
That's the base year. I'm not sure I answered your question, though. Every year, the department will receive financial statements from every facility in the state, but not at the same month every year.
Well, I guess I don't understand all of the scope of the work and what each auditor has, but as paperwork goes, it seems like whenever we come up with some timeline, there has to be some kind of a flex in there to say that if the facility goes ahead and says, this is it, and they've submitted their documents, and then the auditor comes in, and they got a nickel and dime the facility to get the reports back and they're not, you know, to get all the paperwork shuffled back and forth, those things take a lot of time. So I don't know where the line is. I tend to agree that there should be some kind of a time line, whether it should be 6 months or 2 years, I don't know, you know, but there seems to be something in there, and then if there's a huge difference in the equations, or if there's gross neglect or something, then there should be the ability to that the time frame does not stand up, so something to that effect. And I don't know how to address it, Madam Chair, but I still feel that there should be something worked out.
Well, the point is we're not, as I indicated, we're not moving this bill today, and that's I see some room for discussion in some of these areas, so we will pursue that. But every, as I understand, am I not correct, that every facility, although they may have differing fiscal years, makes a report. It becomes the basis, really, for, but 2 years back, it becomes the basis for setting the rates for the ensuing year. And so the question then is whether on those reports that are filed annually, what period of time there should be for the audit review of those. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct. And Senator Menard was referring to something that one of the finance officers at a facility talked about yesterday, and that is that there may be cases where the facilities don't submit their cost reports by the deadline.
It's
set, and our recommendation there would be that the auditors have 6 months to complete their audit after either the date it was due or the date it was submitted, whichever comes later.
On that point,
Senator Hoffman, go ahead.
To have a fixed 6 months after the audit is done, it depends upon the condition of the books. You know, many times you have audit recommendations that they should be changing certain bookkeeping procedures, and there could be a very different system between one facility and another facility, and it may require a lot more time. It's hard to say, well, we're just going to give you 6 months after the audit. Many of the audits may take three times to get completed because of the conditions of those books, and you don't require each facility to say, well, we're going to, once we start your audit, it's going to be completed in 6 months. That would be unreasonable, right? Or given a fixed time. It all depends on the condition of the financial records of the institution, and to put that type of stringent requirement, it just doesn't seem to make sense. I've seen some facilities, some people go into a facility and get the audit done with depending on their comptroller in weeks, and other times that same audit may take a year, depending on the condition of the book. So I would say that to put a 6 month requirement may be unreasonable at this time at the completion of the audit, because those people still have to go back and verify those numbers.
Well, Madam Chair, there may very well be some facilities whose records would not be in condition to get the audit done on a timely basis, and we've suggested to the department in previous discussions about this bill that they put language in the bill or in the regulations that allows them to identify those areas that have to stay open beyond the normal deadline, rather than just leaving it open so that every facility is subject to audits coming in 4 or 5 years later and requesting recruitment.
I think we've had some good experience with the oil disputes of going back and running into statute of limitations and all different kinds of problems. So I think it's a good discussion. Are there other questions of Mr. Pesca? Is there anything you wish to add, Gary, at this time?
No, thank you.
Fine, thank you. Let's go now to teleconference. We have Donna Herbert, but we will hear first from Carl Garber. You signed up first. Would you identify yourself for the record, and then please give us your testimony?
Yes, thank you, Senator Chalisky. My name is Carl Garber. I'm the Director of Finance at Our Lady of Compassion Care Center, a 224-bed long-term care facility in Anchorage. Our Lady is owned and operated by the Sisters of Providence. To give you an understanding of the extent of my financial and audit experience, begin by telling you a little bit about my background before I comment on Senate Bill 288. I've been in Alaska and working on financial matters for over 15 years. My business experience includes approximately 5 years in Big 8 public accounting and becoming a CPA, 2 years as a controller with an electrical contractor and equipment business, 3 years as a sole practicing CPA concentrating on audits of public utilities throughout Alaska. I've been with the Sisters of Providence for the past 5 years, initially as manager of accounting at Providence Hospital, and now as the Chief Financial Officer of Our Lady of Compassion Care Center. During this time, I've worked on many committees in conjunction with the department and the association to address issues of reimbursement. Currently, I'm serving on the department's steering committee to develop a new Medicaid system of reimbursement for facilities in Alaska. So today, I have some prepared comments on Senate Bill 288. It is my understanding that the department feels it is necessary to specifically allow for retrospective audit recoupment because it is good, prudent business policy, and due to a recent Supreme Court decision that stated the right doesn't currently exist because Alaska has a prospective system of reimbursement. The court did point out that the department may have a common law right, and as Gary Pesca just stated, does have a right to retroactively coup in the cases of fraud or misrepresentation. In my opinion, the state of Alaska doesn't need the right to be able to retroactively recoup overpayments except in the cases of fraud and misrepresentation. It would result in undue government influence, be totally contrary to the intent of Alaska's prospective system, and could result in causing the inability to provide the appropriate care to Alaskans. The state doesn't need the right to retrospectively recoup except for fraud and misrepresentation. The system of reimbursement for long-term care facilities in Alaska is designed to reimburse costs per day times the number of Medicaid patient days. The department currently reviews our patient days on a current basis and determines if they are eligible for Medicaid. The department also currently settles up with facilities after the end of the year, multiplying these known Medicaid days times the daily rate. Therefore, the only thing the department needs to audit are the allowable costs that are inflated forward that establish the daily rate. As I have previously stated, if there is any fraud or misrepresentation of these costs, they can and should be retroactively recouped. However, in the case of differences of interpretation, it is not reasonable for the department to be identifying these several years after the fact and somehow expecting facilities to establish reserves to fund for these unknown amounts. As I stated, the system of reimbursement allows for cost reimbursement only, excluding charity care and returns on investment. Therefore, there is no source of funds from current or past operations to pay for these misinterpretations. Where then will the funds come from? They would have to come from somewhere. I believe they would come at the expense of future patient care. Currently, the department is auditing for these misinterpretations of allowable costs several years after the fact. They want to now create a law that would give them the right to recoup in these situations. This would be a poor business policy because it does not encourage the department to mitigate the overpayments. The department would not be trying to identify differences on a current basis, and therefore they would be repeated for several years prior to being identified. It would also be a poor business policy because it does not reflect reality and is in conflict with report protocol requirements. Business, particularly healthcare, is constantly changing. Healthcare is the second most regulated industry in the United States, second only to nuclear energy. Healthcare facilities have specific timelines to report specific information in a specific format to government watchdogs. I do not use the term watchdogs in a negative manner. Rather, I believe it is the government's responsibility to protect the funds of its citizens. However, a reasonable balance must be maintained. To allow the department to have an unlimited period to audit for honest misinterpretation is not a fair balance of government influence. Remember, submitted costs have already been audited by CPAs. All of my reported costs include all CPA adjustments. Also, as stated by Eric Peska, it is contrary to the basic underlying principles of our prospective system of reimbursement. In the prospective system, you agree to the prices up front, and then you base your agreements with your employees and vendors in a large part based on the agreed upon rate of reimbursement that you reached in advance of the year. It is not reasonable to allow for retrospective adjustments in a prospective system, especially when there is really no means to fund for retrospective adjustments. If retrospective adjustments are allowed, we would need to redesign the fundamental system of reimbursement. Finally, I would like to illustrate how the department could be auditing on a timely basis with virtually no changes to the current system, which would identify differences of interpretation and protect the people of Alaska from unnecessary overpayments to facilities. I would like to review that process with you. I think Eric Peska was going to distribute a one-page handout titled Example of Prospective 1993 Rates Based on Audited Information. Does everyone have a copy of that?
No.
Gary, do you have a copy available for distribution?
We do it.
He's
looking for it.
Scrambling right now, but we will get that before us. Senator Cotton?
Meanwhile, can I ask a question?
Certainly,
there?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Most of us haven't had much experience in this, so I'm still struggling with some of the real basic questions that come up here, and I guess the most basic is, what's the difference between a misinterpretation and a misrepresentation? And is that line always easy to discern? Is it always a bright line? Could you give us some, us lay people, a couple of quick examples of a misinterpretation and a misrepresentation? Maybe a couple sets of examples. One set that would be obviously easy to discern, and perhaps a set of examples that might not be so easy to distinguish.
Well, in my particular case, we have this is Carl Harper again. We have 3 years of audits for which we have final audit reports, and the results of those audits. In our case, there was two types of adjustments that occurred, and it is my understanding that they are both considered not to be misrepresentations or fraud. One had to do with the offsetting of interest income that is earned on working capital funds set aside for working capital purposes versus funds set aside for future funding of depreciation, future funding of plant. There is a very specific regulation that says you can't commingle those. Now, I'm not saying that ignorance should be excused, but regulations are immense. And prior to my time beginning at the facility wasn't aware of that regulation. And we thought we were, based on my knowledge, we were setting aside funds for future funding of plant. And the department came in and identified this problem and cited us for our misinterpretation. And this was after we had already done it for 1985, 1986, and 1987, because the audit was so late. The problem was not mitigated, it was repeated. We didn't have knowledge of it. The other type of audit adjustment, and over a 3-year period of time, I want to say that was about, average, I think it was about $20,000 a year, I think. I think 1 year might have been 50,000 and the other two, 20, for 85, 86, and 87. The other audit adjustment of significance had to do with a 1987 adjustment where the department rate setters made an error setting our rate. They made a calculation error. Again, in this case, we were obviously not at fault for that. It did occur right when we had the last round of recent major regulation changes on how to set reimbursement rates. When that happens, those types of things can happen. I'm sensitive to that. However, we had already, by the time it was brought to our knowledge in the 89, we had already made our business decisions, paid our employees, made contracts with our vendors, a large part based on the prospective rate that was established for 1987. Those are two examples that I can offer, Senator.
Senator Cotton.
Yeah, just let me follow up, and it's still, I guess it isn't really always a bright line because I could see some confusion there. What happens there? I mean, obviously, if you have gains from a working capital account that should be considered differently than from a construction account, and I understand you point out you didn't understand the difference there, but I suppose, you know, two people could come to different conclusions there. One could suggest it was a misinterpretation, and another could suggest it was a misrepresentation. So it seems like, you don't get away from the disputes here in spite of, trying to separate those two.
I'm sure you just can't draw a fine line between those, a difference between a misinterpretation and a misrepresentation. I'm sure that is very difficult to do. I think we could work at trying to define it, but I don't think it's going to come down to a real fine line. But I do think there is a possibility to attempt some discussions in that area.
Thank you. Do you have anything else you wish to add?
Was Gary able to hand out the document?
Yes, the example of prospective 1990, three rates based on audited information?
If I could just run through that, I would then conclude my comments.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Again, this is not the association's position paper. These are my ideas, although I don't think they're unique ideas because other states use this similar approach, this concept. But basically, the only change that would occur would be that facilities would file their cost reports 1 month earlier than they're currently doing. They would file them March 31st. Then the department would have 1 month. This is divided into two columns, desk reviews versus field audit. And they would embark on the desk review side initially. They would have 1 month to review that cost report and determine what items they wanted to look at, what items of exposure or risk they felt that could possibly be there. It's pretty apparent to see significant changes from one cost report to another because it is required to be in a very specific, detailed format. The facilities would then have 1 month also to respond to that request. The department would then have 1 month to issue its preliminary report. Facilities would then have 1 month to respond to that report. But at June 30th, the department could make its decision by that point whether it wanted to issue a desk review or whether it wanted to proceed with a full field audit. Like I said, there are many states that rely heavily on desk reviews because they have thousands of facilities. Alaska has, as stated earlier, 29. At that point, you would either go to the right side or stay in the left column. Be up to the department. I'm going to proceed first through the left column, assuming the department wanted to do a desk review. The department would then issue a final desk review on August 31 after having received the facility's response, having a month to do that. Facilities would then have 1 month to appeal those desk review items. Facilities would then submit their year-end submittal to the department, just as we always do right now, on the end of October, the 1st of November. The department then has generally sets rates for year-end facilities on December 15th. So therefore, there's a regulatory requirement that they advance notice facilities. I believe it's 20 days in advance. And so 20 days backdated from December 15th is November the 25th. This would give the department desk-reviewed audited numbers in which to base the rate on. If there were appealed audit issues, if the facility appealed them, those items could be settled when those appeal items are finally resolved. Those could, in effect, be subject to subsequent recoupment, if you will, retroactive recoupment. But the facilities, by that point, would be put on notice that these are risks, and the facility could estimate the exposure of those risks and make their business decisions correspondingly. If the audit were to go over to the field audit, if in June 30th the department decided that they wanted to do a full field audit, which I believe is not necessary the majority of the time, the vast majority of the time, but if they so elected, the department's field audit would be completed within 2 months. I believe for the majority of the facilities in the state that the records are in good condition. We are all required to submit annually to audited financial statements by CPAs. So I believe that, for the most part, our records are in pretty good condition. The department would then issue their final report 1 month after the completion of their field audit on September 30th. The facilities would have 1 month to respond to the preliminary audit report. Again, at that stage, the audit would go on to the final stages. However, the rate needs to be set. And again, any agreed-to items would be included in the rate, and any appealed items would be held until finally resolved. Just a quick comment. Just by changing one regulatory item, we could achieve this. I believe the department has the resources to do it. I believe that there could be some allocations of personnel between the Medicaid Rate Advisory Commission staff and the audit department.
That's interesting.
Where the only going to improve training and further understanding of the whole reimbursement system. Also, in my case, I am one of the facilities with a home office cost report. I've never had a home office adjustment that I am aware of, but counting for me, I would be prepared to hold to allow recoupment for any possible home office cost report adjustments that came up 2 to 3 years after the fact. So in conclusion, Senate Bill 288 should not become law because retroactive recoupment for misinterpretation of allowable costs would be, one, contrary to the principle of current auditing for eligibility, two, would not be able to be funded, three, would result in unmitigated claims of overpayment, four, would be contrary to the regulatory requirements of timely reporting, five, would be contrary to the basic principles of a prospective reimbursement system, six, would likely result in a weakening of our ability to provide needed long-term care service in Alaska, and finally, seven, the people of Alaska are already protected from unnecessary overpayments. Thank you for allowing me time to make these comments.
Thank you. Other than that, it's a jolly good idea, right? Are there questions of Mr. Garber? Senator?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Actually, not so much a question, because he gave us quite a plateful on that presentation, but I would like sometime in your framework to have the department kind of review this and come back and give us a response to see what
it's obvious that we need to do quite a bit further here. Since we have a captive audience and we'll keep Donna with us, I will go ahead to hear Jane Griffith. I believe that's the only individual that is there in addition to Carl Garber. Jane, would you go ahead, please?
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on Senate Bill 288. My name is Jane Griffith. I'm the Director of Finance at Providence Hospital, which is also an organization owned by the Sisters of Providence, so Carl and I are co-team members, I should say, or colleagues. What I pretty much want to say is I'm supportive of the testimony given to you by Gary Peska and Carl Garber. I want to just take just a few brief moments to emphasize a couple of points that I think are very key in this whole process. First of all, the Medicaid rate setting system, or actually any health care rate setting system, is a very complex one, and I appreciate your time to go through and try to understand our issues. It's not easy for the facilities, it's not easy for the state. A lot of time and energy has been spent on the current system. We are looking at trying to revise the system. I think one of the points I wish to make is I believe that some of the audit adjustments that some of the facilities have seen, or at least in my case, some of the conversations I have had with auditors really deal with changing personnel at both the facilities and at the state. The regulations governing the Medicaid rate system right now, I believe, are vague in some areas and are not clear. In some areas, they refer to the Medicare cost principles in one sense. In another session of the regulations, they refer to the GAAP, which is generally accounting accepted principles. In some cases, GAAP and the Medicare costing principles are in direct conflict with each other. And when you're a facility, you're not real sure if the regulations are referring to both of them or one or the other. That has caused problems in terms of when I'm trying to work with the MRAC or the MRC, depending on which year it was, which one do you follow? I think that the improvement of the rate setting system through regulations, either to a new system or clarifying the existing one, helps both the state and the facilities alleviate large audit adjustments as a result of whatever you want to call them, misrepresentations or misinterpretations, either way. In the past, when we were based off a cost reimbursement system, whether it was Medicare or Medicaid, the audit process was the final authority as to what the facility received for reimbursement for these patients. In those cases, and I'm talking about the early 80s now, audits were more timely for both Medicare and Medicaid because time was of the essence. Currently, the Medicare system because it is under a true, and I mean true prospective payment system, with the exception of capital and certain pieces of outpatients, the audits now have lagged between 2 to 3 to 4 years. However, the audits result in very little, if no, change in the actual reimbursement to the facilities. In other words, the federal system has taken on a stance that says, yes, we do need to have audits, but since the reimbursements to the hospitals aren't affected that much, the importance of audits are no longer as primary to a facility's physical well-being as they used to be. I think we need to keep that in mind. The Medicaid auditors in the past have relied upon the Medicare audit adjustments, and so sometimes, since the audit has been late, Medicaid has been later than the Medicare. Well, you can no longer rely upon that, because Medicare is probably going to, at some point, I would predict in the very, very near future, review or eliminate what we currently have known as being Medicare audit functions. Or if they do audit, it's going to be such a small piece of a facility's cost that they'll be able to come in and audit within a day or so. I'll give you an example. The last field audit that Providence Hospital have, and I do want to mention that we are the largest facility. We are, in terms of complexity of cost reports, complexity of our operations, you expect to have auditors come in and spend a great deal of time with us. The last time we had a Medicare auditor in here, they spent, in a field audit, between 60 and 80 staff hours at our facility. And I think from the beginning of the time that I first got their notice to the time I got their final notice was less than 6 months. Based upon that experience, I would expect that we could do the same thing for Medicaid. Again, with the understanding that some other facilities don't have the complexity as we do. Now I'm talking about review time, back and forth, the use of fax machines and overnight mail has made accounting life and timing of audits tremendously easier than it used to be. But I do have to stress that in those cases, time is really of the essence when you do impact a facility's reimbursement. That no longer is the case for Medicare. I want to describe just the audit process that Medicare follows and typically what Medicaid does, just to give you a little bit more understanding of what happens. What happens in an audit is they take your cost report, they compare last year's cost report, look at the variances between, just the numerical variances between last year versus this year. They ask the facility for an explanation for these wide variances. What they're looking for is changes and trends in your own cost makeup. Then what they do is they review, there's a section of the cost report that adjusts for disallowed items. They review those adjustments. They validate your statistics, as Carl said, which are patient days, admissions, your utilization statistics. They then review your general ledger for any items that they think look suspicious. Now, we are all governed, again, by the same accounting rules in terms of general ledgers. We all receive audits, so we all pretty much have similar formats, if not the exact same format. Based upon this, they ask all these questions. From the listing I just gave you, they come up with audit adjustments, and then they rerun your cost reports or your Medicaid reports, depending on who it is. And then those are your adjustments. Now, I've tried to make it sound simple so you can understand it. It does take a lot of time and energy, but it is not so complicated that you can't complete these kinds of issues on a desk review timely, in my opinion. As Carl mentioned, I want to mention about the home office cost report. I've been with the Sisters of Providence for 12 years now. 8 of those years, I've been actively involved with the hospital's cost report. During the whole 8 years, we have not received a significant audit adjustment from Medicare. As Carl said, if that is one of the hang-ups, we could hold that up, because quite frankly, our home office costs are not so material to the Medicaid reimbursement program that would distort our reimbursement very much at all for anyone. In conclusion, I guess I would be supportive of the concept of desk audits before final rate is set. We have never, as an industry said, if you want to use audited data, or if audited data is your final word on how your rates should be set, then you need to set it up front, is what we've been saying from day one. If you have a retrospective system, then let's make it a retrospective system in the true sense of the word. What we have right now is a hybrid system. Medicaid program is much more than it really needs to be, and it's one of our goals or challenges as a provider of healthcare services to community is to reduce our healthcare costs. I think we in the state need to jointly reduce these administrative costs, of which some of them are legal costs because of all this disagreements and the vagueness of the Medicaid rate system. Those things need to be clear of, and we as an industry and we in the state need to accept that responsibility and do it. I'm making it sound very clear, but I guess part of it is my own experience that we've been through this system for now 6 years, and we're now just now saying, well, okay, I think maybe we need to take a look at this audit thing, and maybe we need to fix it. Well, we need to fix it, or we need to fix it one way or the other. I am in support of not having retroactive reimbursement or recoupment based on retroactive audits. It's been brought to some of our attention, both Carl and I, that there is an item that relates to the Sisters of Providence that's been recently brought up in the last 6 months where we may receive additional reimbursement for prior years if this were to pass. That's all well and good, but quite frankly, I still am in support of a prospective system that is true prospective in nature so that I can, as a finance person, plan on my costs, plan on the reimbursement, and then make my decisions accordingly rather than retroactively. I think that's all that I have in closing, and I'll take any questions if I can answer anything. Thank you for your time.
Fine. Thank you very much, Jane. Are there questions of Jane Griffith, please? Not at this time, thank you. And the final person we have to hear from today would be Donna Herbert, and you are here as a from the Financial Consultants of Alaska, is that correct?
That's correct. I represent 8 of the hospitals and nursing homes in the state. My comments are going to be very brief. I think you have heard enough about Medicaid audits and desk reviews probably to last a lifetime here, so... Again, my facilities feel that any adjustment to the rates need to be prospective. We need to be able to plan. The small facilities have a very poor cash flow. Some of them have difficulty meeting payroll. If forward rates are adjusted, they have time to freeze salaries, cut fringes, do other things, raise revenue, do something. But if you're going back retrospectively 3 or 4 years, they don't have the ability to handle that in their system. The timeliness of the audits are very important, and the scope of the audit. Currently, one of our main concerns is the facility sends in an audit and a detailed general ledger to the MRAC staff, and they set the rates accordingly on audited information. The MRAC staff is sometimes making mistakes on those calculations. Currently, the auditors will not audit the MRAC mistakes and say they're only going to audit the facility side, and there is no coordination between those two. We think that's very inappropriate. Because of the complexity and the time that we've taken today, we'd like to see this taken to some sort of a work session where we have the opportunity to work with the department. The bill, as it's currently proposed, is full of conflicts, and it's very confusing. It needs to be drafted in better language, I believe, before it becomes before you again.
Fine. Thank you. Donna, I'm interested in one comment you made about the lack of cooperation between those setting the prospective rates and, say, not an audit of that process. What you're saying, could that mean that at the time of the audit, that you may pick up errors made on the side of the government that may reflect in overages and underages, but at a later point, that there's not, quote, a kind of a check on the process used in setting those rates, so that it has to come as a part which might give you money back, or it might mean that you would need to give money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the facilities have pointed out to the auditors that in a current year that's being desk reviewed or audited, there was mistakes on the calculations. And they're saying, that's not our function. We don't know about the calculations. There's no coordination whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that's appropriate.
Okay, fine. Thank you very
much.
I don't believe we had anyone else. We had a lot of issues brought up. Senator Fisher has indicated to me that he would like to chair a a subcommittee to work on this bill with the department and individuals, and I don't know if Senator Fisher, is that still after hearing all this testimony?
Yes, but after hearing the final speaker and the one prior to that, I think it can, it's a problem I think can be solved.
Would anybody like to volunteer to work with him on this issue? Well, we'll certainly check, but I think what it's going to take, and Senator Fisher and I have just had a minute to chat here, it's going to take bringing people in and talking about this and going through in very much into detail, and there's no objection, we'll let you have a crack at it, Senator Menard.
I'd work with Senator Fisher. I'd like to at least be at the meeting when he has.
Fine, thank you. So we will keep the public hearing open on this and work with the department and with the interested representatives of the hospital to see if we can find some accord and a way to move forward on this. And we won't set a timeline, but would appreciate moving ahead on it. I know this is, it's an issue that does need to be resolved, and that would certainly be the goal. Thank you. We have a few minutes before 10. We have Senate Bill 325, the elected municipal officials, and this is Senator Fisher's bill. We do have
another Fisher bill.
328.
I'm sorry, 328.
Jeez, Fisher's getting to be a big spender around here.
Sessional analysis is before us, and some backup from what happens to other kinds of boards and commissions. And Senator Fisher, what have you got here?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman.
This one doesn't cost anything.
No, it doesn't cost anything. It's presently what happens, the state law usually sets the maximum of a municipal official as to the term length. For example, if you're going to be a city mayor, it's 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go beyond that. But there's nothing at the other end. In the case of Kenai, for example, you can be there 30 days and run for a school board or assembly. And I passed out a sheet showing all kinds of offices and what they are. And if you talk to the man on the street, they think it's a year for anything as a minimum. And I don't know why the state just doesn't say, leave it in existence now, the 3 years. And that would be the maximum. For example, the city of Kenai, if you're going to run for the city council, you got to have a 3-year residency. Cordova is a 3-year residency. And there was a court case based on Cordova where the state Supreme Court agreed that 3 years is not unreasonable, that whoever's running for office should know something about the community. And so all this does is just say it's a year, and they have the flexibility, the municipalities still have the flexibility anywhere between that year and 3 years, whatever they want to do. But I was shocked when I found out just last year that you only have to be in our borough 30 days to run for office.
Senator Cotton.
Can the local governments require that now?
What?
To be there a year?
Yes.
So why are we doing it then?
Well, we set the other end in the region.